I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Professor Bernard Wasserstein, the author of On the Eve, The Jews of Europe Before the Second World War. We'll also have visits from our two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gilbert. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. I know that June 20th or so is the actual official beginning of summer, but since I live in the Sonoran Desert and summer sometimes begins in April, not this year, but sometimes, I think it's fair to treat this as a summer edition of Two Jewish, which brought to mind one of the really interesting episodes of my career, the four-month period of time when I served as a student rabbi and cantor at a congregation in Sydney, Australia, some 18 years ago. First of all, Australia is a great place, and Sydney is a tremendous city, truly world-class in every way, with wonderful culture, art, music, natural and man-made scenery, beaches, food, coffee, recreation, sports, you name it, it's terrific. The Jewish community in Australia is involved and knowledgeable, and I had one of the most interesting and pleasurable times in all of my long service as a cantor and then a rabbi. The people in Sydney were warm and bright and interesting, the work challenging but enjoyable and fulfilling, and just when I would begin to think that it was all very similar to being a Jewish clergyman in California except for the accents, I would look up and see a giant kookaburra sitting in the tree over my head, or somebody would ask everybody at the table to rise to toast the Queen of England. Anyway, it was a really cool set of experiences for me as a young near rabbi. And those experiences taught me something important about the calendar and the way we experience our Jewish ritual year. You know, I went to work in Australia all those years ago at exactly this time of year, June, and I recall leaving early summer weather in the U.S., landing in Australia, and realizing with a start that it was actually early winter there. Now, winter in Sydney is not exactly winter in Siberia. It's quite temperate and generally cool and very pleasant. But it was very different to be preparing for the high holy days during the winter, when everybody was busy with work and school instead of the summer. And it was even stranger to me to have Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur and Sukkot occur in the spring. In Australia, and I assume in Argentina and Brazil and South Africa and everywhere south of the equator where Jews live, Passover comes not in the springtime, but in the autumn. And Hanukkah is a summer festival, and Simchat Torah falls in the spring. If you, like me, are used to holidays falling in a particular season, and suddenly they switch to the opposite season, this is a little bit like entering a parallel religious universe. Mind you, this seasonal flopping seems not to have materially affected the Jewish communities of the Southern Hemisphere, many of which have been thriving for centuries. But it was somewhat mind-blowing to me when I served in Australia, conditioned as I am to a quieter summer, followed by a deep plunge into full synagogue activity for a new school year, high holiday services following immediately thereafter. It's very different down under. The major fall festivals come in the spring, at a time of quite normal school and work activities. There's no pause before the high holy day plunge at all. Which raises an interesting question about the Jewish calendar and our hemisphere-centric conception that holidays, as they occur in the Northern Hemisphere, specifically wherever it is that we ourselves live, are the only way to properly celebrate being Jewish. The argument that's typically made for preserving the Jewish calendar, even in places like Australia that are on the opposite seasonal clock, or places like the tropics where the weather is the same year-round, is that we are celebrating the festive cycle as they do in Eretz Yisrael, the holy land of Israel, the place intended for all Jews to fulfill mitzvot fully. Everywhere else is just a pale substitute for Israel. Even New York City, even Sydney, even Tucson. Still, it brings up the fact that calendars, no matter how regular they are also arbitrary. They were all established in a particular place at a particular time, and they reflect that bias. The Jewish calendar was created over some centuries in Israel and later completed in Babylonia, with additions made eventually in Europe and North Africa, and then in the 20th century, back in Israel again. But how we live the calendar is very much dependent on where we are living, when we live the calendar. Which makes me wonder just how Judaism would work in outer space, should we ever manage to colonize it. You know the old Jewish astronaut joke? A priest, a minister, and a rabbi go into a space shuttle and orbit the Earth. When they get back, the media asks what they thought about it. The priest says, "Beautiful. It made me see God's beauty and greatness." The minister says, "It was fantastic. I see how truly small we all are in the eyes of God." And the rabbi says, "Oy, it was horrible. Horrible, I tell you." "Horrible," the reporters say. "How could it be horrible to go to space?" "Every 15 minutes is the rabbi. On with the tefillin, off with the tefillin, on with the tefillin, off with the tefillin. Shachris, mincha, mariv." You see, every day we're supposed to do three prayer services and put on tefillin, leather prayer phylacteries, in the morning. And if you're orbiting the Earth, every hour would be a complete day and you'd have to do it all again. And okay, forget it. Anyway, the key concept to remember here is that how we live our lives, the way we celebrate Judaism, is not really dependent on where we live or even what season it is. We can find ways to make our experience meaningful and holy, and to keep our Jewish identities fresh and vibrant at any time of year, on any and every continent on this beautiful globe of ours. So to play us in this morning, here's a morning song, Matovu, the first prayer sung on entering the synagogue, no matter the season. "How good are your tents, Jacob, your dwelling places, Israel," wherever they are. A setting from Danny Meseng, well known in the Reform movement.
Matovu, Matovu, Ohalecha Yaakov, Mishkenotecha Yisrael. Matovu, Matovu, Ohalecha Yaakov, Mishkenotecha Yisrael. V'ani berov chasdecha ahavoh beitecha eshtachav elecha al kodshecha le'yiratecha. Matovu, Matovu,
that was Danny Meseng's Matovu for this beautiful Sunday morning. You know, so often when some huge event hits, we remember where we were based on the experience that followed. But rarely in life do people have the kind of prophetic ability that allows them to understand their present-day experience based on something that hasn't yet happened. Our guest this morning, the distinguished professor Bernard Wasserstein, has written a powerful description of the Jews of Europe on the eve of the Holocaust, viewing the largest and most influential Jewish community in the world as it then existed, not as a foreshadowing of disaster to come. It's a telling, beautiful, and profound narrative. Find out how he created it, and maybe more importantly, why, when we come back on Too Jewish.
Hi, Joe Spina, Mama's Pizza. When we were kids, my mom used to tell Vinny and me, "Take time and smell the meatballs." Back then, Vinny and I always took this literally. After all, the smell of meatballs was often present in our home. But as time has gone by, we've learned there's more to Mom's reminder. Now we know that when you stop and smell the meatballs, you're really taking time to do stuff with attention, love, and care. In restaurant terms, it means we need to select the right ingredients for our pizzas, sandwiches, and salads. We need to simmer our sauces for just the right amount of time. We need to hand assemble our calzones and lovingly season and bake our garlic cheese toast. Yes, at Mama's, to stop and smell the meatballs means lots of things, including taking time to sometimes actually stop and smell the meatballs. Because trust me, they do smell good. Mama's Pizza with 4 convenient locations. Now repeat after me. Mama's Pizza.
Parents in Tucson have many choices on where to send their children to school. Consider the best. Consider Tucson Hebrew Academy. Now is the time to secure your spot for the upcoming school year. With a beautiful Foothills K-8 campus and award-winning academics, you owe it to your children to visit THA, Tucson Hebrew Academy, and see what they have to offer. Your child belongs at THA. THA delivers. Low student-teacher ratio supports successful, rigorous academics, and they don't stop there. With an emphasis on the arts, science, and music, THA students learn the Hebrew language and are taught Jewish values along with a rigorous academic curriculum. Your child deserves the best. Call 529-3888 to schedule your tour of THA. Financial aid is available. Don't wait. Space is limited. That's 529-3888 or visit www.thaaz.org. We're delighted to welcome to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Bernard Wasserstein, a distinguished academic and the author of the new book, On the Eve, The Jews of Europe Before the Second World War. Dr. Wasserstein is the Harriet and Ulrich Meyer Professor of Modern European Jewish History at the University of Chicago Department of History. His degrees are from Oxford, and he has a long and remarkable history of publications, of monographs, articles, and books on Jewish history in many different areas. Tell us what prompted you to write On the Eve.
Well, most of my books begin themselves rather than my deciding to begin them. In this case, I had been saying for many, many years that I felt and feel that there is an imbalance between the attention we rightly give to the Shoah and to the destruction of the Jews of Europe during World War II by the Nazis, on the one hand, and the comparative lack of attention that we give to what was destroyed. And I'd been saying this for many years, and saying that we were spending too much time discussing exactly how gas chambers work, and too little time looking at the culture and the civilization that was eliminated by the Nazis. And I decided after all these years of saying it, that it was about time I did something about it. And so I found myself writing this book.
You know, it's a fascinating glimpse. You make a really interesting case about the divisions among the Jews of Europe before the Second War. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, there were tremendous dividing lines of all kinds, as there have always been throughout Jewish history.
Excuse me, imagine that, Jews who don't get along. You know, how could that be?
Yeah. Exactly. But unfortunately, in Europe, in the 1930s, these divisions were even deeper than perhaps at any other period. There were profound divisions among Jews on religious lines. There were the ultra-Orthodox Jews, particularly concentrated in Poland and Lithuania and some parts of Hungary and Romania. There were the mainstream Orthodox and conservative Jews. There were the liberal Jews, or neologs as they were called in Hungary, and then there were the large group of secular Jews, particularly in Western Europe and also in the Soviet Union and elsewhere. And these just didn't just not get along. They hardly talked to one another. They hardly recognized one another as belonging to acceptable forms of Jewish identification. But it wasn't just religious differences. There were profound political differences. The left, the communists and the socialists, the Zionists, the so-called assimilationists, and then the liberals and others. Then there were differences based on origin. There were, of course, the differences between Ashkenazi Jews in Northern Europe, Yiddish-speaking Jews in the main, and Sephardi Jews, those Jews, many of whom still spoke Judeo-Espanol, who lived in Southern Europe, particularly in the Balkans. There were also the differences within Ashkenazi communities between so-called Litvaks and Galicianas, Litvaks hailing originally from the Lithuanian, a larger area than what is now Lithuania, and Galicianas hailing mainly from southern Poland. So there were all these differences, and in particular, as the pressure from outside grew in the 1930s, the pressure from anti-Semitism, not just from the Nazis, but all over Europe, the Jews found it impossible, really, to come to any kind of consensus as to how to confront the challenge that they were faced with.
We will talk much more about the Jewish community of Europe on the eve of the Second World War with Bernard Wasserstein when we come back on Too Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can stream all past and present shows through the website or download us from there or from the Apple iTunes store as very popular Jewish podcasts. And now, we are pleased and serene at welcoming back a randomly recurring feature of Too Jewish, Zen Judaism. To find serenity, one must be serene. To find peace, one must be peaceful. To find bargains, one must shop. That was a koan of Zen Judaism. We welcome our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbart, head of the Israel Center here in Tucson. Good morning, Guy. Boker Tov.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
We've been talking about the Israeli educational system. Last week we talked about all of the different sort of subdivisions of the Orthodox educational system, religious schools they're called in English typically, and that incorporates perhaps 15% of the Israeli population, but a larger percentage of the younger kids. Tell us now about what do Chiloni Israelis, that is, Israelis who don't identify as specifically religious and don't go to the religious schools do, that's still the vast majority of Israelis, what's that school system like, and what do they learn beyond English, math, science, the kinds of things you would expect?
I think we should start by saying that the Israeli Chiloni, the Israeli secular, is totally different than what you would define as secular in the States. About 90% of Israeli seculars will fast on Yom Kippur, and about 97% will not drive a car on Yom Kippur.
Right.
Nearly all secular Jews in Israel celebrate all the religious holidays. They will do a full Seder meal at Passover and read the Haggadah from beginning to end with all the traditions and the glass of wine and hiding the afikoman and everything, which for an American eye would look, hey, they're Orthodox.
Right.
So many people kind of in a jokey way would refer to Israeli Chilonim as Orthodox seculars.
Now, I might also say a whole bunch of secular Israelis go home to their mother for Shabbat dinner on Friday night. It still blows me away when I'm there. They might go out afterwards, but they're going home for family dinner.
They'll go home, and when they go back from their mother's house, they'll probably carry bags with food for the rest of the Shabbat that they bring for their mother.
Right.
And then there is this delicate issue with their wife, you know. Do you like your mother food better than you like mine?
But you speak about this from knowledge, I see, Guy. Okay,
In my case, my wife cooks the best. And
But and your mother's not listening to the show, so that works out well.
I don't know. She tends to hear everything. Anyhow, we were talking about education. The secular kids in Israel, through their education system, they learn Hebrew, read and write.
Of course, they're completely obviously. Fluent.
They learn the Tanakh, right. Which is the Torah, Nevi'im, Ketuvim.
It's taught really the Hebrew Bible as history to a degree, or geography, or sometimes, you know, local
true, but
events.
They are taught it from a more of a scientific perspective,
right.
And not from the religion faith perspective. We are witnessing a concerning phenomenon in the last years of more and more youngsters, teenagers, and students that refer to Judaism as if it was the ultra-Orthodox version of Judaism, the Haredi version. And those youngsters come and say, you know what? The Haredim, they are Jews, so I'm not Jewish, I'm Israeli. And that's a very concerning issue that we see, because people are misinterpreting
the
concept of being Jewish.
Concept of being Jewish. So, in essence, the Chiloni system is a good educational system, better in some places than others, like every educational system in the world, but gives a general grounding in Jewish history, but not a whole bunch of liturgy, prayer, religious experience, the way an American Jew would perceive it.
Right, but you need to remember that also in literature classes, you will write about Sifrut. Israeli poets. History, right. We'll talk about Jewish history. Geography is geography of Israel and, you know, places where Jews have been. And so they get by far more Jewish education
than what a
kid in the States will get in a Jewish day school.
Thanks, Guy. We'll talk next week.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom. Just back from Hungary.
Good morning, Rabbi. Yeah, back from Hungary, among other places. This is a long trip to Europe for me and visiting a lot of old friends. One new city, which was Trieste, which used to be the port of the Austro-Hungarian Empire or whatever.
And a very international, complicated city.
Yeah, it's like used to be also a very big center of espionage and whatever. Very romantic, great for wine tasters. Not much, not a whole lot in terms of Jewish history. But one place that does have a whole lot of Jewish history is Budapest. And we can talk about that and a little bit about Hungarian Jewry and its very distinguished history.
Distinguished and distinct history. You know, Hungary has always charted, the Jews in Hungary have always kind of charted their own course, whether it was their unique version of kind of conservative orthodoxy, neo-log Judaism, whether it was, it's their, of course, coming, using Hungarian, a unique language, they don't really speak Yiddish,
right.
Whether it's, you know, the rich culture, very interesting and different kind of Jewish community.
Right, and I am blessed to have had two grandparents who came from there, from a city that during the course of one century was part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, then it was part of Hungary, then it was part of Czechoslovakia, then it was part of the Soviet Union, and then it was part of Ukraine. So people who lived in that
same
city
town
changed nationalities and passports if they lived 100 years five times.
Wow.
It's pretty amazing. All right, so Budapest, all through the Cold War years, was the biggest Jewish community in Eastern Europe, not obviously bigger than the two biggest communities in the former Soviet Union. But in Eastern Europe, per se, outside the Soviet Union, Budapest had the most Jews and the most active Jewish life institutionally. There was always a rabbinical school there. There were still bar mitzvahs. There were functioning synagogues. Jewish life was not stamped out by the communists, nor was it completely destroyed by the Holocaust the way it was in so many smaller places. Budapest has a very distinctive major synagogue called the Dohain Utsa Templum.
Which incredible is
the,
building.
In English, the Tobacco Street Synagogue, which is a classic for its era. There was an era from roughly 1875 to 1915 or so when Jews built synagogues emphasizing their Orientalism. And so they looked like big mosques. They had these big domes. There's one in San Francisco like this. There's one in Seattle. Emmanuel. Somebody told me there's one in Cincinnati.
There is, with the Plum Street Temple in Cincinnati. Right. And for that matter, in Rome and, you know, many other places.
Well, the one in Rome doesn't really look like a mosque. I mean, it looks like a giant church. It's got a big dome. It's got a dome, but it also looks like...
It's got a lot of blue.
Like,
I don't know.
St. Peter's.
All right. I mean, we can argue this later.
Right. But definitely the one in Budapest is very Oriental in its motifs, both inside and outside. And the community has subsequently attached a wonderful Jewish museum to that synagogue. So one can visit the museum, that synagogue, other synagogues, other functioning communal institutions, kosher restaurants, whatever. Budapest has a rich and diverse Jewish life, reflecting in part the fact that all of Hungary once had a rich, diverse Jewish life, and that many secondary Hungarian cities, and I guess we can talk about this next week, have remnants, more or less active, of the active communal life that they once enjoyed.
Should also say, great place to go on your summer vacation, Budapest. And I had the privilege of singing on the beam of the Dohain Synagogue with their cantor, who was really a great cantor, doing a duet. And I tell you, it's a fantastic
cool.
thing.
Good acoustics, I'll bet.
Great acoustics. Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week.
Look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a Public Service. The old rabbi is dying in the hospital, barely conscious, surrounded by worried congregants. What a great speaker! His sermons were so inspiring, one says. The best rabbi ever, agrees another, and a great fundraiser. He took such good care of his family. As busy as he was, he always had time for them, says a third. And what a brilliant teacher, says another congregant. He could patiently explain Torah, Talmud, everything to anyone, no matter how hard the text or how ignorant the student. And a community leader, too. He was the best, says another. Finally, everyone falls silent. After a few moments of calm, the rabbi weakly opens one eye and says, "And about my modesty, you say nothing?" That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature to Jewish Just for You. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we chant the dramatic portion of Shlach Lecha from the Book of Numbers, the story of the Meraglim, the spies. The Israelites have journeyed to the borders of the Holy Land just a year and a half after leaving Egyptian exile. Under God's direction, Moses sends 12 spies, one from each tribe, princes of the people, wealthy men of standing, into the land of Canaan to scout out the land and to see how it will be captured. The spies take a month, and they see the whole land and report back to Moses that it is very good, flowing with milk and honey. They bring back a huge cluster of grapes, so large it has to be carried by two men on a pole, now the enduring symbol of Israel's tourism ministry. Everything's going to be great, but it's not. 10 of the 12 spies report that the people of the land are huge. We felt like grasshoppers next to them, they say, and numerous. The cities are fortified and unassailable. The Israelites have no chance, in spite of having God's support. Two spies, Caleb and Joshua, deliver a minority report saying that with God's help, the land can be taken. But the people are terrified. Again, they ask Moses and Aaron, "Why did you take us from slavery to kill us here at the hands of our enemies?" It's at this point the decision is made by God. This generation of former slaves will never be able to become a free people in its own land. The psychological shackles of slavery are too strong to overthrow in just one generation. So, after a failed leaderless attempt to invade the land without God's approval or Moses' leadership, the people are condemned to wander the wilderness for 38 more years, a total of 40 since they left Egyptian slavery,
until a new, young generation can emerge to take the reins and enter the land with a mentality of freedom. It's a great lesson in the process that is required to cleanse the trauma of oppression and failure from the minds of a community. Often, it's not one single act or great revolution that truly remakes a people or a country. It's the generational turn that comes from learning that things can be done differently and that freedom is a birthright. When we come back on Too Jewish, our guest, Dr. Bernard Wasserstein, will show us a world that is gone, but was extraordinary in nearly every way. Find out all about it when we return on Too Jewish.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary from Rabbi Sam Kohan, newscasting from Israel.
Here in Israel this week, the Knesset rejected a bill to prevent the razing of buildings in the illegal Ulpana neighborhood of Beit El. Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu opposed the bill, which would have circumvented a Supreme Court ruling ordering the dismantling of five buildings in Ulpana. It's a wildcat settlement built on private Palestinian land by legalizing the outposts. But he warned after the vote that he would not allow anyone to use the legal system to harm the settlement movement, and then announced plans to add 300 new homes to Beit El near the city of Ramallah. Beit El will be expanded, the 30 families will remain in Beit El, and 300 new families will join them. Netanyahu has backed a plan to move the buildings in Ulpana, home to 30 families, stone by stone to Beit El itself. Instead of diminishing Beit El, expanding it, instead of harming the settlements, strengthening them, he said. Netanyahu has come under attack for his decision opposing the legislation to circumvent the Supreme Court. That opposition has come from his own right wing. But Netanyahu insisted his government remained a champion of the settlers. I understand your pain. I share it. No government would support the settlement movement more than the one I head. We will continue to strengthen the settlement movement and strengthen the democracy. Without commenting on the Ulpana demolition rule, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas slammed Netanyahu's statement that he would expand Beit El, which he said would hinder peace efforts. We strongly condemn Netanyahu's announcement of the settlement decision on Palestinian land, which is an obstacle to efforts to push the peace process forward, said Abbas's spokesman Nabil Abu Rudena in Paris, where the Palestinian leader is going to meet new French President Francois Hollande this week. The Knesset vote in Israel, which saw 69 MPs opposing the legalization bill against just 22 in favor, ended legislative efforts by the settler lobby and its right-wing supporters to avoid the court-mandated July 1 removal date in Ulpana. The bills sought to offer compensation to Palestinians whose private land had been taken by settlers rather than returning the land itself. A second similar bill was taken off the Knesset agenda before the vote. The planned demolition, which affects 142 people, had sparked fury among settlers and their backers and exposed a small split within Netanyahu's own right-wing Likud party. Before and after the vote, Netanyahu made clear he opposed all efforts because they could spark an international backlash. The law rejected today would have harmed the settlement movement, he said. But the movement has responded with anger anyway. Outside the Knesset, about 2,000 people reacted angrily to the bill's failure, chanting, "Jews, do not evict Jews." Police said five people were arrested for disturbances, despite a commanding majority of 94 votes within the 120-seat Knesset. Netanyahu has struggled to rein in some far-right members of Likud, many of whom said they would back the bills, but in truth, he is now free to reject the demands of the most extreme members of his coalition without fear of losing power, and Netanyahu is beginning to do so. Members of the government praised the outcome. Intelligence Minister Dan Meridor of Likud called it a show of the seriousness of this government not to act outside the rule of law. That didn't help in Turkey. Turkish Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan used his keynote address at the Regional World Economic Forum around here to slam Israel over conditions in the Gaza Strip. People are being jailed in the world's largest open-air prison, Erdogan said, referring to Israel's six-year-old blockade of Gaza, one of the issues that has led to a crumbling of ties between allies, Turkey and Israel, although probably not the most important one. In 2009, Erdogan provoked a spat with Israeli Prime Minister Shimon Peres and stormed out of a WEF meeting in Davos, Switzerland, accusing Israel of murdering innocents by airstrikes. A staunch supporter of a sovereign Palestinian state, the Turkish Prime Minister also called on business people to channel investments to impoverished parts of the world, including the Palestinian territories. Mahmoud Abbas, who took the stage after Erdogan, urged the world to address the deadlocked peace process between Israel and the Palestinians. The ongoing Israeli occupation does not allow an economic cycle to occur in our lands. Horizons for investment are elusive in Palestine, Abbas said, although the truth is the West Bank has been doing very well economically the last several years. In fact, probably better than America. More than 1,000 business and government representatives attended the two-day WEF meeting in the Middle East, North African, and Eurasian regions. In a move unlikely to win Israel any new friends abroad, Israeli scientists have figured out how to neutralize the chemical in marijuana that makes users high. A new type of marijuana developed in Israel contains no THC, the active ingredient in the cannabis plant that causes mind-altering effects when the plant is smoked. Instead, a new breed contains a higher level of CBD, cannabidiol, another component of the plant which is not inducing of highs, but does offer beneficial effects for patients suffering various symptoms. Mother Earth has given us multiple species of marijuana, each with its own attributes and effects. I know lots of people that have researched this in depth, but nothing quite like this has been invented. The world's media coverage of the Israeli innovation has been ambivalent. Technology website Gizmodo called the Israeli researchers killjoy scientists, accusing them of having bred the fun out of medical marijuana. And Tzachi Klein, head of development for Tikkun Olam, Repairing the World, the company that developed the new species, is proud of the development. Klein said his weed has the same taste, smell, and shape as regular marijuana, but without the high. Kind of like alcohol-free beer. I wonder if you still get the munchies. And if you do, do you suddenly crave fat-free muffins? And in Philadelphia, Muhammad Ali's grandson recently was bar mitzvah. Believe it or not, the 13-year-old boy, Jacob Wertheimer, is the son of Ali's daughter, Kalia Ali Wertheimer, and her husband, Spencer Wertheimer. I was born and raised as a Muslim, the mother said, but I'm not into organized religion. I'm more spiritual than religious. My husband's Jewish. Nobody put any pressure on Jacob to believe one way or the other. He chose this on his own because he felt a kinship with Judaism and Jewish culture. Jacob had his bar mitzvah ceremony at Philadelphia's congregation Rodef Shalom on April 28th. And that's the news of Jews around the world.
We welcome back to Two Jewish. Our guest this morning, Professor Bernard Wasserstein, the Ulrich and Harriet Meyer Professor of Modern European Jewish History at the University of Chicago. From 1996 to 2000, he was president of the Oxford Center for Hebrew and Jewish Studies, the recipient of a Guggenheim Award in 2008. He is a guest fellow this year and speaking to us from the Swedish Collegium for Advanced Studies in Sweden. His most recent book is On the Eve, The Jews of Europe Before the Second World War. You know, was there also, among the divisions you spoke about within the Jewish community of Europe before the Second World War, there were also class divisions, weren't there, because of the tremendous success of some Jews in a variety of countries economically and socially?
Yes, there were very profound class divisions, primarily based on the division between the very small wealthy elite, the upper middle class of professionals and successful business people, and then the great mass of Jews who in the main were in really an impossible economic position, particularly in East Central Europe, in Poland, where the largest Jewish community in Europe lived, and in Romania and Hungary and certain other countries. And the economic position of the Jews in the 1930s was made even more acute, not only by the Great Depression, which of course affected everybody, but by the growing economic anti-Semitism, which resulted in boycotts of Jewish businesses and legislation in many countries to drive Jews out of certain professions. They were forbidden to own taverns, to have business licenses for many kinds of businesses in countries like Romania. They were prevented from practicing law or medicine in certain countries. This drove Jews very often to the edge of starvation and penury and beyond and over the edge. And it accentuated the misery that the Jewish communities in Europe faced, not only arising from anti-Semitism, but also from this acute economic crisis of the 1930s.
In writing about the civilization, basically the Jewish civilization of Europe, is it almost impossible not to see the Holocaust coming, whether they could see it or not? I mean, how difficult is it to remain objective about what was going on before the end starts?
One of the surprising things to me, one of the shocking things to me, when I completed my research for this book, was the extent to which Jews did see it coming. It's very often alleged that Jews were insouciant and unobservant about what was going on around them, about the threat that they faced. But in fact, if you look at the evidence, you find that there were again and again warnings by Jewish leaders. Take, for example, the case of Rabbi Leo Beck, the liberal Jewish rabbi who was the head of the Jewish community in Germany, the last head of the Jewish community in Germany in the 1930s. As early as the spring of 1933, very soon after Hitler came to power, he said, I quote, "The 1,000 years of history of Jews in Germany has come to an end," unquote. And I cite in my book many other examples of foresight of Jewish leaders talking about the threat of total destruction, elimination of Jewish communities throughout the continent. And by the way, it wasn't just a matter of leaders. You find the great Jewish masses voicing this sort of fear in a different sense, voting with their feet by trying to get out of Europe. Some 10% of the entire Jewish population of Europe, of Poland rather, fled in the interwar period, and there was wholesale Jewish emigration from many other parts of Europe. Of course, the more than half the Jewish population of Germany fled in just 6 years, 1933 to 39. Many, many hundreds of thousands more Jews would have fled if other countries had been prepared to receive them. But of course, the United States at that time had a racist immigration policy based on so-called national origins quotas. The Western European democracies admitted some, but only limited numbers of Jews. In Palestine, the so-called Jewish national home that was at that time ruled by the British limited Jewish immigration from 1936 onwards. In fact, by 1938-39, there was only one place on earth where Jewish refugees could enter without a visa, and that was the international port of Shanghai.
Right.
Some 20,000 Jewish refugees descended on Shanghai. Before that, too, that possibility, too, was closed to them. So many, many hundreds of thousands of Jews did flee, and thereby show just how foresighted they were, and many more would have done so if they'd been able to. So what surprised me was the extent of foresight. Of course, there were some people who said, "We are too old. We have nowhere to go. We have we have no possibility of getting in anywhere in any case," and so they remained behind. The notion that the great mass of Jews in Europe were Pollyanna-ish about their fate does not hold water if you look at the evidence.
You know, this book is a magisterial work. I mean, it's an extraordinary amount of detail, although it's very readable. When I look at some of the categories, you know, everything from the Titans of Industry to the smugglers and the horse thieves are covered here. When you started in this, did you think it was going to be quite... I mean, you're really trying to record a civilization that's gone.
I was trying to do something slightly different, not just record a civilization that was gone, but to try to take a picture of a moving train, because one of the other things that emerged from my work on the book was that the challenge that faced Jewish civilization in Europe wasn't just from outside, it was also from within. And Jewish civilization in Europe was already in a state of what I call close to terminal decline by the late 1930s. And one can see this in many senses. The Jewish birth rate, for instance, was well below replacement rate in the interwar period, and it was getting lower and lower in the 1930s. The Jews, in fact, some statisticians at the time, some demographers, forecast that the Jews in Europe were in danger of dying out just for that reason alone. Jewish culture, too, was in many measurable ways in a state of decline. For example, Jewish languages, the main vehicle, after all, of culture is language. Jewish languages were in a rapid state of decline. Yiddish was... still spoken by many millions of Jews in Poland and in the Soviet Union in particular, but mainly old people, young people spoke Polish or Russian respectively. And in the Balkans, Judeo-Espanol, the language of the Sephardi Jews, was already close to dying out in many parts of that region by the late 1930s. So what I show in the book is that in these and other ways, the challenge that faced Jews, to their collective survival, that challenge came as much from within as from without.
One of the really interesting aspects, probably should realize it, but it wasn't so clear to me, is the number of people who were trying to pass as Jews, converting, hiding their origins.
Pass, when you say pass, you mean pass as non-Jews.
Jews passing as non-Jews, of course.
Yes.
And converting out. Had been going on for a long time. There's lots of stories about it. But was it more acute in that period, you think, or was it similar to what had been going on for a while?
No, it was more acute in that period for very understandable reasons, because of the pressure from anti-Semitism throughout Europe. I mean, one of the things I want to stress in this book, I try to stress, is the fact that the challenge didn't just come from Hitler or from the Nazis. In every country in Europe, even in the democracies, you had heightened anti-Semitism. In fact, one of the striking things is that in the summer of 1939, shortly before the outbreak of the war, there were more Jews behind barbed wire in concentration camps in countries other than Nazi Germany than in Nazi Germany, and even in some of the democracies, in France and in Belgium and the Netherlands, for example. But going back to your question, I've wandered a bit, I'm sorry. Going back to your question about passing, yes, as a result of the pressure of anti-Semitism, Jews did do very often, not all Jews, of course, but an appreciable number, very often did try to pass as non-Jews, for example, by changing their names. In Germany, they tried to change their names from recognizably Jewish names like Cohen or Levy to more German-sounding names. And similarly, in Hungary or in the Soviet Union, this was happening throughout Europe, both family names and forenames. But it wasn't just that. Jews also, for that reason, stopped speaking Jewish languages very often except in the privacy of their homes. They are very often, in other words, tried to conceal their Jewishness. Not the majority of Jews, but an appreciable minority.
There is something, of course, tragic about the book, even while it's describing great vibrance, tremendous musical accomplishment, all of the sort of positives. There's sort of reinforcing something you said earlier about what Rabbi Leo Beck said, and a concert in 1933, you know, Weltgutnacht, about sort of the end of Jewish participation, full participation in culture when the Nazis come to power. What do you think were the possibilities? I mean, were there any possibilities missed by Jews living in Europe? You know, they did try to leave. There were not so many places they could go. Was there anything else that they might have done? And as a historian, of course, you know, hypotheticals are always interesting, but still, I'd like to ask you to conjecture just a little.
One of the striking things to me is that, you know, of course, one can have one's sympathies, political sympathies, ideological sympathies. One can say they could have done this, they should have done that. But what is striking to me is that, in fact, everything was tried. There were those who tried participating in political activities from the right of the spectrum to the left of the spectrum. When I say the right of the spectrum, there were Jews in Germany who were close to being Nazis. And to the left of the spectrum, of course, to communism and beyond, to the even further left. There were Jews who were Zionists, there were Jews who were so-called territorialists, who looked for a Jewish national home somewhere other than Palestine, in almost every country in the world, from Alaska to Angola to Australia. There were those who tried persuasion, trying to persuade their enemies to listen to reason. But of course that didn't work against the the blaring propaganda machines of the anti-Semites. There were those who tried prayer, and I don't have anything to say for or against that. I do say in my book, and I stand by these words, that their God did not listen to them. And I don't think any even the most orthodox or religious person can claim otherwise. I say that very much as a Jew who cares about Jews.
Sure.
And then there were those who tried flight. But as I say, the possibilities for flight were limited in a world where the doors were closing or already closed. So everything was tried. And I think what history showed was that, whether you tried to pass as a non-Jew, whether you tried to emigrate, whether you tried to persuade your enemies, whether you tried to organize politically, these solutions might work for individuals, but in terms of saving the Jewish collectivity, none of these things worked.
You could say that neither God nor man listened. Book is called On the Eve by Bernard Wasserstein, Jews of Europe Before the Second World War. It's a tremendous book. I want to thank you for a great visit here on Too Jewish.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out on Too Jewish.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 a.m. when our very interesting guest will be the energetic and committed Michelle Levine, Outreach Director of the Society for the Protection of Nature in Israel. And of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or our TooJewishRadio.com website, and like us on Facebook. Our playout this morning comes for Shabbat, coming to a synagogue near you this Friday night and Saturday, as it does every week. It's the very energetic and fun Safam version of Yismachu. God gave us the Sabbath for celebration and joy. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace. Yismachu.